The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. And today I'd like to welcome back to the program Peter James. He joins us by telephone from Los Angeles area. Hello, Peter.
Vic, hi. Good morning.
Peter, you've got a new book out in the United States. I understand you just flew in. Did you fly all the way from England to the West Coast?
Yeah, it's always a long one, Matt. It's about 10, 11-hour flight, and then we have an 8-hour time difference. So I think, yeah, most people walk around it like a zombie for a little bit. But I've done it so long, I think I'm just permanent jet lag, so I just got used to it.
Well, as we're speaking to you, it's actually very early in the morning in Los Angeles. I imagine most of the denizens of Beverly Hills are sound asleep, except for you. And I understand
you're the only man awake in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Hundreds of people probably pounding away in gyms all around the place.
Yeah, you're probably right. I understand you were out late last night. What were you doing?
Yeah, I did an event with Michael Connelly. It was actually a BAFTA a hosted event, British Association of Film and Television Arts. So he and I kind of in conversation with another writer who's a crime writer with the LA Times. And it was a really fun evening. We had about 150 people in the audience, and we were just talking about the joys of working with our books for adaptations, and the joys and the nightmares.
Well, I think he just had a birthday, didn't he?
Yes, quite recently. I mean, he looks younger every time I see him.
The only reason I know that is because the last time I was in Los Angeles, I was there for a book expo, and that would have been probably about the end of May, and we went to his birthday party.
Oh, wow.
So I had to have had one at the end of May there. Anyway, Michael Connelly.
Yeah, I was really delighted to do the event because he's long been my kind of favorite U.S. crime writer, and he's a really nice guy.
And Michael.
And he's very funny.
He generally sets his books in Los Angeles. You set your books generally in an area of England called Sussex. Tell us about this area.
Yes, the main city in Sussex is Brighton and Hove, which is a very famous seaside resort. It goes right back to Regency days when kind of rich Londoners would come down, and it got a reputation back then as a dirty weekend resort. It was always had a slightly sort of naughty, racy reputation. And then when the London-Brighton railway line opened up in 1840, all the kind of villains in London, and London was not a nice place to be, so they all tumbled down to Brighton, and they brought with them cockfighting and prostitution and protection racketeering, you know, all the kind of nice stuff that we have in our modern society. And they stayed because it was a much nicer place to be. And basically, Brighton became really a haven for villains. I mean, in 1932, it was called the crime capital of the UK and the murder capital of Europe. Huh. And it's a title that's never left. It's the last three chief constables told me it is the favored place to live in the UK for first division criminals. And I just, by sheer luck, happened to be born and raised there. And hardly anybody before me wrote about it. So it's not a place that's sort of been widely used and trampled on. So it was very much kind of fresh territory for me.
Peter James joins us, and his latest book in the series that features Roy Grace in Brighton and Hove is called Need You Dead, and all of these book titles have the word dead in them, don't they?
Yeah, I started doing that. I mean, the first in the series was called Dead Simple. And for a long time before, my earlier novels, my pre-Roy Grace novels, I tended to have one-word titles. And the problem is there is no copyright in a title. And I had one novel called Alchemists, and then The Kohelo Alchemists came out. And I had a novel called Twilight. Let me know what happened that, you know, the next Twilight. And when I created the Roy Grace series, and I thought, okay, I'll have more than one word. I'll try and make something that would be obvious if anybody were to copy it. And the first title that's worked is Dead Simple. And then I came up with the title for the second book, Looking Good Dead. And I thought, actually, I quite like this. And then by the third book, Not Dead Enough, people started calling it the Dead series. And I thought, well, that's great. People remember it.
Mm.
And so I've just carried on. And as you say, Need You Dead is the 13th. And it ain't dead yet.
No, it certainly isn't. And this is one of the more complicated ones that you've written. You really had me thrown. Sometimes I have a better sense of who done it in some of your other books. But in this one, you keep confusing everything, and it's very clever how you do it. Let's talk about Roy Grace. Who is this guy?
Well, Roy Grace is inspired and to quite a large extent based on a real-life former detective chief superintendent, head of homicide for Sussex, who I kind of met back in 1995 when he was a young detective. And we became friends, and he rose up through the ranks and in 2002 became promoted to head of homicide. Just at the time, my publishers asked if I'd ever thought of creating a detective as a central character. And I went to Dave Gaylor, and his name is Dave Gaylor, and I said, how would you like to be a fictional cop? And he loved the idea. I mean, he's like one of my best friends today, and we work very closely together. So in terms of Roy Grace is partly very much a real person, and I find it incredibly helpful to have a real live guy who's done exactly this role, because when I'm planning each book, we sit down and we discuss it. Dave reads every 100 pages and tells me how Roy Grace would think or act as a real detective would, and it really helps give me that kind of authenticity I try so hard to get. My fictional character of Roy Grace is a very, I always joke that I say that if I was ever unfortunate enough to have a member of my family murdered, Roy Grace is the homicide detective I'd want in charge of the case. He's an extremely human and caring guy, and I wanted to get away when I created Roy from there was very much a kind of cliche in the crime writing, mystery writing world of the detective with a broken marriage and a drink problem. And the reality in England today is no cop with a drink problem would last 24 hours. Just wouldn't happen. And I thought really hard, you know, what detectives do most of all is they solve puzzles. And I figured it'd be kind of interesting to create a detective who had a personal puzzle of his own that he was not able to solve. And when we first meet Roy Grace in Dead Simple, he's coming up to his 39th birthday, and we learn that his wife, Sandy, who he loved and adored, has vanished. He came home ready to take her out for dinner for his birthday, and she just wasn't there. And for 10 years, he's had no idea at all where she could be. He's searched high and low. He doesn't know whether she got abducted, whether she ran off with a lover, had an accident, or whatever. And although he functions as a very effective homicide detective, he can't move forward in his own life because he never knows if one day she's suddenly going to walk back in the door. And then gradually through the series, he does start to move on, and we start to learn a little bit more about what happened. But it's made him in the books, because he's got that personal sadness, it's made him kind of a very human and empathetic person to other victims.
Well, in a way, even though he doesn't have a drink problem, he had the ultimate broken marriage because he didn't know what happened to his wife.
That's right. And it's broken, and there's always the fear he starts a new relationship with Cleo, who runs the mortuary. and eventually they marry. But all the time, he's still dogged by that shadow of what if Sandy just suddenly turns up again one day? And she's dogged by it too. And, you know, she says, "Hey, you know, what would happen?" And he, for a long time, he doesn't know the answer.
And Roy is moving on through time chronologically. He is aging. Some detectives don't age. We have the example of a detective who did age, who then retired, Ian Rankin's Rebus character. And Roy Grace, is he going to have to retire eventually? I mean, he's aging in normal time.
Well, he's aging in very slow time, because when we first met him in Dead Simple, he was just coming up to 39. Now, 13 books later, he's just turning 41.
Oh, okay.
So what I've done is I've moved the books forward a year in kind of space and culture in real time. But in actual real time in the stories, each book starts a few days, sometimes a few weeks after the last one finishes.
Okay.
I wanted to make sure that I didn't have that same problem that happened, you know, with Ian Rankin and Rebus, that the Roy sort of hits retirement age. And also I wanted to show his developing love affair with Claire in sort of slow increments. And if I sort of read each book, you know, a year is a long time in a new relationship. And I've tried really hard to write each book as a complete standalone and to sort of give a thumbnail during the story as to bring any new reader up to speed. So you don't have to, you know, I think you'd get the most out of the series if you were to begin at Dead Simple and read through, but anyone could read Need You Dead without having read any of the others, and I think and we'll be straight up to speed.
Peter James joins us. His new novel is Need You Dead. Are we allowed to talk about Bruno then?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Bruno is sort of the vestigial legacy of his marriage.
Indeed, yes. Roy, you know, many years on after Sandy's disappearance, discovers, one of the things he discovers is that he's got a son he didn't know he had called Bruno. And he and Cleo are married. They've recently had a baby called Noah. And suddenly he finds he's got this son, and he's got to bring him home to live with them. And that's going to be interesting. I'm having kind of some real fun with that. And there's going to be quite a few developments, as I'm sure all my readers can guess. Things ain't going to be completely plain sailing with this kid. Bruno is 11 years old, and quiet, but a little bit strange.
Yeah, Bruno, he's a mystery.
I want to say something you're saying about this book being kind of, that you find it hard to guess who did it, which I'm really pleased, because it's like the first time I've written a real whodunit. Quite a lot of my previous books, you kind of know who's done it, and it's more the pursuit, you know, is Roy Grace going to catch the villain or not, male or female. Here I've written more in that kind of tradition of, you know, multiple suspects, and I had a lot of fun doing it.
Let's talk about the crime, okay? What happened? What is Roy investigating?
Roy's investigating a murder, and the story starts with a woman. She's in an abusive marriage, and she works from home as a hairdresser. And she's been having a love affair for the last 18 months with a guy who's been promising her, a guy called Greg, who's been promising her that he's going to leave his wife, and she'll leave her husband and they'll start a new life together. And he's just taken his wife on holiday to the Maldives, where he's assured one of the character that he's going to tell her that the marriage is over on the holiday. And Lorna has a client who comes in very excitedly, and she's just been on holiday in the Maldives. And she's showing her the holiday snaps. And she looks at the holiday snaps, and she sees this, her lover, Greg, all loved up with this other woman. And she says to her client, who are these? Oh, this is a lovely couple we met. It's so nice to spend time with a couple who really genuinely love each other. And, of course, it turns the whole world upside down. Firstly, because she sees this guy's lied to her about his everything, including Greg is not even his real name. And she basically is going to confront him and destroy him. And then she's found murdered in the bathtub in the Love Nest apartment that they've been secretly renting together. But although he's a suspect, the husband is also a suspect, and more suspects will come out the woodwork. One is a guy called Seymour Darling, who has a kind of record of violence, and he was trying to buy a car from her, which she'd advertised on eBay, a little MX-5 sports car. And they'd agreed a fee, he paid the money over, and she claims that she's never received the money. He thinks she's stolen it. She thinks he's a victim of cybercrime. And so the story kind of builds from there. And I always like to use the latest sort of crime-fighting techniques. I'm always fascinated by the way that police and criminals are constantly playing catch-up with each other. And you know, normally it's the villains who are the inventive ones first, and then the police catch up, and then the villains create something new. In this book, I've actually used something that was discovered and pioneered by the police, and it's called super recognizers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever heard the expression before.
In your books?
Yeah, that's what happened was I got a phone call out the blue from a detective inspector at Scotland Yard, and they said, we'd love you to come up and spend a day with us because we've developed something and we want to publicize to other police forces throughout the UK and around the world because we think it will help them in the struggle against terrorism apart from everything else. And I went up there and I spent a day with this team, and they explained to me that the average human being, probably you and I, Vic, can recognize 23% of faces that we ever see, we've ever seen. The average police officer, the average cop, with all his or her training, can only do 24%. And the world's smartest computer can only recognize 25%. But they discovered there's a tiny percentage of the population who are capable of recognizing up to 95%, literally just from one detail, from the shape of somebody's nose, or shape of their chin or earlobe. And this was invaluable. We had huge riots in London a few years back, massive rioting, looting, I mean, a really explosive time in South London. And a lot of the rioters were wearing baseball caps and hoodies. And so the police had a huge problem identifying them until they discovered that one of their... wasn't actually a police officer, he was a custody officer, had this extraordinary super recognizer power. And he literally sat and watched videos and identified 150 people correctly, who then went on to become prosecuted and imprisoned. And from there, they built up a team of about 150 people, a combination of serving police officers and civilians. And they call them the super recognizers.
And you have a super recognizer in your story, and that's a big part of the story. Why is it that so many of the books in this genre where there's a detective out there trying to solve crimes, that detective seems to frequently have a boss who is a complete jerk?
I think it's all too true. I think, you know, there was a great book written years ago called The Peter Principle, which is that sooner or later in every organization, everyone gets promoted to the level of their incompetence. And I think what tends to happen is that the qualities that make a really good detective are not necessarily the same qualities that actually make a very good manager. And I think because the police promote within always, a lot of the management roles aren't always that well served. And you know, as in any organization, there's a sort of element of arrogance and element of empire building. And you know, Roy Grace is a good detective. He knows when he's right. And he's had a long history of animosity with the Assistant Chief Constable Cassian Pugh, whose life he once saved a few years back, and now sometimes regrets it.
Hmm. Well, you also are always on top of the technology and the latest developments. This recognition system that you talked about is a form of high tech, I think, that is a human form. And then you have all these other things in here that are high tech. You've got the guy who's got the camera set up to film what's going on his street. You've got Roy Grace going on to Twitter. You've got the holiday that was on Facebook. You stay in touch with all this stuff, don't you, Peter?
Yeah, I think as things move forward. I mean, I've always found technology fascinating because I was involved in technology quite early on in the early days of the internet, and in fact, I'm not sure if we've ever talked about this. But my
the
novel,
first electronic book? No, yeah. We've never talked about it. I'm just kidding. Go ahead. Tell them about it.
We have talked about it, haven't we? Yeah, my novel Host in 1993 was published as two floppy disks as the world's first electronic novel. But I do find technology fascinating. And about 12 years ago, I was at Brighton Police Station, and they have a morning meeting every morning at 9 o'clock, which they jokingly call morning prayers. And all the kind of senior police officers policing the city and the surrounding area sit around the big table, and they look at everything that's happened in the last 24 hours, missing persons, vulnerable people, wanted criminals, burglaries, rapes, muggings, the lot. And the commander of Brighton Hope turned to me and he said, "Peter, you've come on a historic day. This is the first day since records began. There's not been an overnight domestic burglary in the city of Brighton and Hove." And I said, "Fantastic, you've won the war on crime." And he laughed. And he said, the old traditional old kind of burglar who'd break into a house in the middle of the night and steal the Georgian silver or whatever, he can make so much more money these days either as a drug dealer or internet fraudster." And he was incredibly prescient because today the two biggest crimes are drug dealing, but an even bigger crime today is internet fraud. I spent some time with the City of London Police, their economic crime unit, and they basically police internet fraud throughout the UK and share information. And there's some really horrendous ones, and there's a horrible one involving mortgages of people trying to buy a house. And that money that, most people, if they're buying a house, it's often, or an apartment, it's their life savings. And these are being targeted by internet fraudsters, and the payments they're making are being directed into accounts overseas, and people are losing everything. And the figure last year in America for mortgage fraud was over $1 billion. And it was around $300 million in the UK. But a much more widespread crime than that is fraud on eBay and Gumtree transactions and those online auction houses. And that's the sort of central plank in the book also, in that you get villains in England, and they'll bring over from, say, Romania. A Romanian gang leader will bring over 100 street people, give them money and a false identity. They all open a bank account. He then sends them back to Romania with a nice payout. So he's now got 100 bank accounts. And he'll watch a transaction of somebody and say, "You're selling me a car." And like in the book, it's a little MX-5, and you want $3,000 for it. And they are monitoring the transactions. And so they would then see the transactions going to take place and that maybe you and I have started to email each other outside of the safety net of eBay.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll get an email from Peter James, but you won't realize that it's actually not my account. It's just one tiny digit different, maybe a full stop in a different place.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, "Oh, Vic, would you mind paying the money to this particular account?"
Through PayPal.
and you do that, and that money is in Romania within 30 seconds.
Wow.
And then the account's closed down and gone. And the police, there are so many things like that going on. The police cannot investigate them, and the villains know that. In England, the police do not look at anything under a minimum of $3,000 and more likely under about $50,000. They just haven't got the resources.
Mm. My guess is Peter James. His latest Roy Grace thriller is Need You Dead. And Peter, when your books come out in the UK, they are bestsellers. They shoot straight up to the top. And I know you've worked diligently to build your readership here in the U.S. I've watched a lot of writers from the U.K. do the same thing. I've seen some of them really succeed, and others are still working at it. What's the secret? How do you figure to break through in the U.S. and become top of the charts over here? What's it going to take? Just hard work? How are you going to do it?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's very interesting. There is a, between America and England, there are actually very few American authors who are really well known in England. You know, there's some great names here, like, you know, Joe Finder, Sandra Brown, you know, huge list, who people just don't know in the UK at all. Yeah, there are, you know, there are some, obviously, who sell really well. And equally, it's the reverse, too. There are very few British authors that sell well over here. And I think partly it's because I think there is a traditional way of the English detective that doesn't appeal so much to America. I think the old style of sort of the Agatha Christie style, which is very much the style of English writers in general, which is, you know, you begin with a dead body in chapter one, and then the rest of the book is a puzzle to solve it. American thriller writers tend to write much more action-packed stories, and in many, if not most, American crime novels, the victim is still alive at the end of chapter one, but in danger.
Uh-huh.
And I think the American style of crime writing is much more gripping than a lot of the way that British crime writers structure their stories. And I've always written in that American style. You know, my victims are usually alive and in peril at the end of chapter one, and often quite well into the story. And it's gone off. It's trying to get, you know, I think that Americans do read a lot of foreign thriller writers. You know, I think the success of Scandinavians with Stieg Larsson and
Joe Nesbø.
Helen Mankell's books show that there is an appetite for it, and Joe Nesbø. And, you know, I'm really happy. I'm sort of feel I'm getting traction bit by bit here. And I love coming over here, so it's no hardship to come over and do bookstore events, and it's always great to talk to you. It's lovely to have a dedicated book program like this.
Peter, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for your time, and also, thanks for keeping my favorite Peter James villain, Tooth, alive.
I learned a long time ago, if you create a great character, don't kill him.
Yeah, I love this guy. Well, thank you so much, Peter.
Great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. The book is Need You Dead, and my guest has been Peter James. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis.